So we're now recording, and my name's Daniel Four. It's sometime in late March 2018, and the focus of the talk is on animism and spirits of place. So before I get into saying anything, I'd like to just pause with each of you to remember what it is that brings us to the topic here. There's a ton that can be said, theoretical, applied, all of it, but there's a heart level reality to being of this earth and related to the many beings, and to be living through a really severe and acute human driven extinction crisis and a great deal of suffering for other humans and for the other than humans both. And so that's the backdrop of how we come into this. And I want to pause just for a moment to invite that awareness or the gravitas as we try to talk about a thing. I'm in the habit of using the word animism to describe this terrain of things. It's not a word I came up with, of course, but it's one that's been re-enlivened or clarified or popularized again by folks like Graham Harvey and other religious studies folks, philosophers, writers, as a way of describing a worldview, a stance, a set of values that says that living humans are just one kind of person. There are many other kinds of people. Some of those people are human, but not incarnate, like the ancestors. Some of those other people are animal or plant-shaped bodies, and some of them are relatives or kin or beings that modern Western science might not consider alive in the same way, like mountains and rivers. But from a animist perspective, are people nonetheless. And so there are many, many other kinds of people. And the way in English of speaking of it that describes these others as people is intentional, because it's saying these others are embody or carry or have, if you will, a personhood, that they are as legitimate in their existence as we are. And because of that, there's a need to morally and ethically reckon with our relationship to them. And so humans are not the only kind of people. When we have interpersonal relationships, the other persons involved may be humans, or they may be other than humans. And that basic stance, when I heard that articulated, I'm like, oh, fantastic. There's a word for it. I've been searching for good language for that for a minute and grappling with, well, earth honoring. Yeah, you could call it earth honoring, but it's also sun, moon, and star honoring, and interdimensional, weird, ancient god honoring. And so it's not just the earth, although I happen to be a devotee of this particular planet. You don't have to be so focused on here in order to be an animist necessarily. And it's not for, like, I could describe this way of seeing the world as paganism, but to me that has a connotation of European sourced traditions, which is okay, because that's my own blood ancestry and I love those traditions, but it's not limited to that for me. And to describe this way of approaching things as shamanism, that may work for many people. For me personally, it is a way of speaking that has become a bit encumbered by the history of colonialism in the Americas, and also more specifically the kind of culture of modern revival forms of shamanism, like Harner method shamanism and things like that, that not always, but often aren't so sensitive to the history of genocide in the Americas, and are taking a handful of techniques and generalizing that as if that's the whole path or orientation. And there can be an implication that a person becomes a shaman just by relating with the other than humans, and I don't see it that way. And so many people may use the language of shamanism. That's fine. I don't want to be a obnoxious word police, culture police kind of person. But for me personally, the descriptor of animism feels a bit more neutral. And the way that we're talking about stuff might remind some folks of what what you associate with indigenous wisdom or indigenous philosophy or spirituality, stuff like that. And the reason I prefer to not describe it in that way is because I think at this point in history, it's good most of the time, at least, to use the word indigenous to refer to things that have to do with indigenous people, indigenous cultures, of which there are, you know, maybe 300-400 million indigenous people on Earth. It has a very political and historical, like, substantial kind of reality to that. Like, I'm not an indigenous person. My ancestors are German, English, Irish, etc., settlers, colonizers to North America. And it doesn't, it's not required to identify with or kind of grasp for the presumed validity of being indigenous in order to love the earth or to love the other beings. And so what I'm suggesting is respect indigenous systems, indigenous spirituality, but unless you're an indigenous person yourself or have trained in those systems, consider that there may be more culturally neutral ways to describe this framework that says living humans are just one kind of person. We're in this big field of relationships, and that has all kinds of implications. So all that is a little bit heady, right? But how we think and talk about what we're up to matters, because if we're not mindful about it, we can exacerbate old pain between, let's say, indigenous and non-indigenous people. We can give a false impression that we're presuming to be a big healer person just because we talk to the trees. And so how we think and speak about it has a lot of implication. So what I'm saying is I'm an animist, or that, you know, I'm considering that is a useful frame to come into this conversation. The second principle here that's important is the spirit of the word indigenous means of a place, right? It means local, to a place. And so I do have an ethic from years of doing land focus or outdoor place oriented ritual that working with the other than humans close to you is the way in general. And work with the land where you're at, because you're already in relationship with those ones. And so some people will say bioregional animism, which I think is great. It's totally a nerdy way to talk about it, but I think it's accurate. I've sometimes used the description spirits of place, but I don't really like it, because the word spirits in English implies other than physical, other than incarnate. And it makes a split in the way we perceive the others. Now, if I say the black bear that gets in our garbage here in Asheville, is that a spirit of place? Yes. Is it the bear spirit? Yes. Is it the bear body? Yes. And so if we're going to use the word spirit, we want to be mindful about how we're perpetuating a spirit and, like, physical, not physical split that isn't actually a part of how a lot of traditional people see the world. So in any case, we're coming in from a framework of animism. And from within that, a local ethic, keeping it close, the relationships that are close. And what I'm going to do here is just highlight a few key principles, and then we'll be in conversation and try to follow where the energy is at for you. Another thing is very important to put out here is these things are learned. When I say these things, what I mean is as soon as we say the other than humans are legitimate community members, that cedar and woodpecker and ant and thunderstorm are part of the community. They're people. They're thunder people and stone people and ant people, but they're also part of our community. Well, there's ethical and moral implications. We have to deal with them. We have to deal with our accountability to them as fellow community members. And ritual is one of the primary ways in which that set of values is taught over time. Ritual traditionally has the function of reminding the community of human relatedness with the other than humans. It's one of the important functions. And so, you know, ritual and other things, just habits, simple habits of etiquette, of walking around instead of stepping in a certain place, whatever it is. And so animism as a set of core values that emphasizes relationships, not only with other humans, but with the other than humans. It's something that's learned. It's not innate. It's not inherited. It's not unique to people of a certain ancestry. If you're born into a tribal community and you're removed from that community and raised to be a good Mormon, you're probably going to see the world a lot like a Mormon would see the world. I don't mean it to be judgy, but Mormons tend on the whole to be somewhat less animist than, you know, tribal peoples. And you might get haunted by your ancestral spirits who are like, whoa, you dropped something along the way. But you're going to basically be seeing the world as you're taught to see it. That's the same for a, you know, WASPy colonizer white person who's raised in a really animistic framework or culture. You're going to tend to see the world in a very relational way. So this stuff is learned. That's good news, because it means that even if you come from a cultural environment or a family of origin that's really heavy or toxic or abusive or reductionistic and does not feed you on a soul level, you can choose to learn these other things. It's not that different from choosing to learn a language. You're learning to reactivate intuitive capacities. You're learning etiquette. You're learning other ways of perceiving and other ways of knowing. So it's learnable, which is great, because I wasn't raised with it. I've come to reclaim that. I'm still doing that. It's my full-time job to teach it. Some of you actually show up and are like, oh, maybe I have something to say about it. So my point is, you can learn as well. It's good to be hopeful about that. And so as I touch on what I see as a few key pieces here about an animist framework, what I don't want to do is have it be compartmentalized into another spiritual choice on the menu of modern Western spiritual choices, because there's something about the way we think of spirituality that gets constructed as a personal, private, almost like self-improvement software or something, like something that's just about helping you to be happier or more well-adjusted or more, more good or something like that. And so I want to take it out of that more limited frame and speak as a citizen of the United States, as a therapist, and as someone who's concerned with cultural healing for a minute, because none of those are explicitly like spiritual practice per se. So as a therapist, a psychotherapist, doctor of psychology, marriage and family therapist, who happens to also be an animist in how I see the world, what I would say is that the way we think of mental and emotional health radically is a radical reduction, an unhelpful way of just looking at living human beings' relationships with themselves or with other living humans. And we even have some blind spots about that, of course. But, you know, setting that aside for the moment, what's typically left out, less so in eco-psychology, but that's a very small element within mental health, is the relationships between living humans and the other than humans. And, you know, we name some of them. And these relationships can be just as important and just as filled with projection and confusion and our own wounding around attachment and our own longing for intimacy and our own avoidance and all the dynamics that we helpfully and unhelpfully create with other living humans absolutely can arise with living humans and the other than humans. This is something very basic, but my guess is that at least some of the folks on the call probably haven't even considered it. Or maybe you have even done training as a therapist, but you probably didn't get training on how to look at the psychodynamics and the complex kinds of projection and things that can arise between the humans and the others, because those relationships don't tend to be valued. And so that's a major blind spot in the kinds of healing that can happen psychologically. Because many people have a shitty, painful childhood where you don't bond well with your caregivers for 1,001 reasons. And so you're left in a series of painful adult relationships trying to figure out how to do attachment and bonding and attunement right. and paying a lot of money for expensive therapy, which hopefully goes well because it can be helpful. And in the meantime, there are thousands of amazing, beautiful beings close to you whose bodies are what we think of as nature, who can be sources of stable attachment and emotionally corrective healing relationships. And so what I'm saying is that from a clinical mental health perspective, we tend to overlook the other than humans. And it's not reducing them to just fulfilling a psychological need for us, but it's also good for them, for us to come back into relationship. So, you know, there's a whole way we could branch the conversation into mental and emotional wellness and how our culture encourages us to really narrowly construct that to include only other living humans as people. So expand personhood to include these others as well. Another domain that matters a good, you know, matters a lot to me, and I'm sure to many of you, is around the critical need for cultural healing at this point in history, not just this point, but, you know, a lot of things seem to be becoming more conscious, I would hope, or at least more available through the information around the history of, and not just history, but ongoing realities of racism, of sexism, of colonialism, of religious intolerance and environmental, you know, destruction of the other than humans, etc. So there's a lot of cultural toxicity that all you have to do is read the news, log onto Facebook, or just try to leave the house if you're a person of color or whatever it is. So there's a lot of stuff we're trying to metabolize, obviously. And what happens sometimes, it definitely doesn't happen all the time, but it happens quite a bit, is people who are very committed and very skillful in one area of cultural healing will have a blind spot or not be very skillful in another. Like the basic sensibility of Kimberly Crenshaw's work and intersectionality, insofar as it's an invitation to see that different kinds of oppression or problematic cultural dynamics can't be separated out, that they intersect and relate with one another. And so what happens is that the other than humans often get left out of the conversation. And this is a kind of erasure, a silencing, and that can happen for all kinds of reasons. It can happen, it's understandable that people of color who don't have, you know, basic safety or needs or clean drinking water might not feel sympathetic to, you know, a Save the Whales campaign, because it's not for all kinds of reasons. There's a kind of a privilege to being able to focus on that. So there are reasons, of course, that, you know, there are ways in which environmental activism can have a lot of blind spots around privilege and race. Now, having said that, we're deeply in it together. And if we exclude the other than humans from the way we look at cultural change, we are recreating and reinforcing a colonialist or reductionistic way of coming at cultural healing. And some of the communities that model a more integrative approach to this, generally speaking, at least from my own experience, I know there are others in other parts of the world, but Native North American, or just Native American, First Nations, Indigenous people throughout the Americas tend, generally speaking, to approach, you know, pushback on colonialism or, you know, work for social justice or cultural healing in a way that does include the voices and the connectivity with the other than humans. And in that way, I think that ethic of including them as part of how we think of society is inspiring and exemplary if we're going to have lasting cultural change work. And so, I've migrated away recently even from the language of social justice. I was trying to say social and earth justice. And I, because to even say that implies that if I say social, people aren't going to think the other than humans are part of society. And it's like social, oh, and by the way, earth as well. And so the split it's tough to move away from in English. So moving back to just the language of cultural healing. But my point is, notice how you approach your activism and your cultural change, and challenge yourself to be deeply mindful to the history of racism and colonialism and all the things that we're trying to be on our game about, and know how to leverage change around without omitting the voices and the dependence we have on an inseparability with the other than humans too. So see if you can hold an all the above angle on it. It's a challenge a bit. So one other point to avoid being in the realm of talking about it as spiritual practice is, legally and politically, we tend in this culture to ascribe personhood just to living humans, and also to corporations and maybe boats or like certain other types of possessions. And as an animist, I don't actually have a problem with saying corporations or people or boats or people. It's just they shouldn't be prioritized over the other than human people, like mountains and rivers and whatnot. And so if you look at the rights of nature movement in places like Ecuador and Peru and Bolivia and New Zealand and some parts of India even, and there are rivers, mountains, and not just animals and plants, but also those ones who are getting more legal traction and getting the status of legal personhood. And that's where we need to head, legally and politically. What I'm saying is, the idea should be mainstream. It should be the standard by which anyone would have a hope for getting elected for public office, is to be very clear that personhood legally and politically is extended not just to living humans, but to the land, to the animals, the plants, the fungi, the stones, the rivers, etc. And if you don't have that ethic or morality, you should be shamed into silence about the topic, because and just made to listen instead of lead, because you're not ready to lead. And we have a profound accountability to the others, and it's not a native thing, it's not an indigenous thing, it's a human thing. And respect to indigenous cultures who've kept that sensibility alive. May we have the humility to learn from those who wish to share about that. And it's a human thing. It's something that should be mainstream, period. It's basic ethics. And to not hold that ethical stance is as socially unacceptable as racism or sexism, etc. So that's how I really feel about that. Let me say a few other things, and then we'll be in dialogue, because I'm already talking more than I imagined. Look, for context, I've been teaching about ancestors forever. I love it. It's what I do. It's kind of my focus. And so just to start to circle back to talking about the others that are not ancestors is exciting to me. So I have a lot to say about it, actually. But I've been limiting myself to the ancestor focus for so long, so I actually have probably 3 hours of stuff to say. So my point with all I just said is that to be an animist, you don't have to be a ritualist. That's one certain kind of way it can be expressed. You don't have to be into spirituality, per se. It's a set of core values. You can be a really animist DJ or a really animist truck driver. It doesn't matter. Like when we were in Nigeria last trip, there was a whole, like, 30 minutes we were praying over the engine of a car and spraying gin on the car and singing for Ogun and just, like, may this car be so healthy, et cetera, et cetera. Now, is that spirituality, or is that just, like, taking good care of your car? It's practical, right? So, anyways, you don't have to be a spiritual person. You don't need a spiritual identity. You don't need a whole new spiritual thing to be holding the core values of relatedness that extend beyond human to human. Okay, so a few key principles. I'm going to say five or six succinct principles, then we'll be in dialogue. So one is to really work with what's local. And I mentioned this before, but we don't need to reach for relationship with the others. We're already in relationship. Chances are you've eaten in the last 24 hours, meaning you've either personally killed or paid someone else to kill the bodies of plants and animals so you could put their bodies into your body and have their life force energy power you to do things like listen to this call. So we're killing others to live. that's intimate, and that's a great starting point for bringing our relatedness more conscious. And the land where we're at, like to just stop, introduce your own ancestors to the land and to the ancestors of the land where you're at. Great start. But to look at the beings that are already around you, the beings whose bodies form the house, the structure that you're in, to give, you know, acknowledgement to the electrical fire and the silicon and the metals that are being used right now for us to be able to talk. And so there are no objects from a deeply animist perspective. They're all different kinds of people. And you might need to slow down and tune in enough to know how to dialogue with certain kinds of people. And they may or may not want to talk to you in that moment, but you can try. And so we don't have to reach for new exotic things. The others are already around us. We're already in relationship. It's a shifting from less conscious to more conscious rather than reaching for a new thing. The second principle is that your personal affinities are going to be different from the next person. So your way in is going to be different. There's no one script to follow here. There's some core values, but there's a lot of different ways that the enactment of those values can look. For you, enacting an animist kind of ethic might look like fancy ritual because you're a ritualist and you like that. For somebody else, it might not look like that at all. And so we're not talking about a religion. We're talking about a set of core values, right? And the tendency is for us to attract different kinds of beings or people other than humans that are either really similar to us, and so they reflect back something about our nature, or that are very different than us, that come to challenge us to grow and to instigate us, to, you know, shake us out of our stuckness. Or ones that are close by and that we have to reckon with because we are up in their space. So those are the most common types of ones that cross our path. And what's another important principle is that most of these others don't care about us. Don't expect them to care about you one way or another. The vast majority, they just don't have a feeling about specifically you one way or another. Why would they? You're not thinking about them. They're not thinking about you. Now, there are a small percentage of them that are quite harmful, potentially. Most of them still don't care about you, but if you get up in their space, they might notice you and then relate harmfully towards you. And a whole other category that are helpful, which can be called upon, or they might just come to you in a helpful way. But to remember that most of the others aren't focused on you. Some of them are big enough to totally crush your life, and others are, their voices are very quiet or subtle in relation to your voice. It doesn't make them less, but they might not be ones that you would seek as teachers per se, or not in a direct way. Yeah. So it's important to allow for a whole spectrum, all different kinds of encounters. They're not all in this lateral power dynamic where they're equal, so to speak. We tend generally in American culture to want to see everyone as an equal. And it's, I don't know of any other cultures that do it like that. I think it's a weird, like, shadow of democracy or something. But it's important to not bring that, it's a kind of rigidity to not bring that into how we relate with the others. I'm going to say a few more things about some general principles, and then we'll see where the energy is at for the dialogue. These others have their own agency. It's very, very important to not see them just as they relate to you. And a common example would be picking a flower. Now, you might be walking and just pluck a flower from from the ground. And if I say you're walking, and you just non-consensually rip the sexual organs off of another person, now, that feels different than picking a flower when I say it that way. But that's what you're doing. And it doesn't mean there wouldn't necessarily be permission if you stopped and tuned into that plant person and be like, hey, how's it going, friend? You're beautiful. Like, would it be permissible for me to gather some of these flowers? And they might be like, oh, yes, thank you for asking. Yes, I was going to, pollinate and enjoy my body, but there's enough to spare and you seem polite. Let's have the adventure. Go ahead, pull them off. And, but we don't tend to have that consideration. And I would go a step farther to say that our environmental crisis, the hemorrhaging of biological diversity that's happening on the planet right now, the doom that I'm assuming you're all aware of, I see it as an ongoing consent violation, to use human-to-human relational terms for it, of taking without permission. It's not that taking is inherently bad because we kill and we take to live, but the taking without consideration, without seeking permission, without gratitude and acknowledgement is the problem, or is at the heart of the problem. And there's a whole, in the animism course, the second lesson is all about killing and eating and the intimacy of having to kill the bodies of others to eat. And we start with looking at domesticated plants and animals, because if we eat their bodies, totally overlook them, and go connect with wolves and bears, we've skipped a step. And the fourth lesson is all about boundaries and consent and being able to hear no. Ritually, a critically important skill is to be able to do nothing at all and to sit and wait until you have permission to do a thing. And to be willing to hear no. If you ask, hey, can we do this ceremony here, whatever, whatever? No. The answer is, it's not up to a yes. Maybe is still a version of no. And so take the same ethics you would apply to sex with other humans and bring that careful attention that hopefully you have cultivated as an adult, even if you weren't encouraged to have that as a young person, and bring that same consideration to how you relate with the other than humans. Now, if we did that, there'd be a massive, rapid change in all kinds of policy across the world, because it's we're looking at ongoing consent violations and how we relate with the others by just taking their bodies without asking. And so it's damaging psychologically to us, and is harmful to the relational field, of course. So finally, and then we'll be in dialogue, is there's grief and heartache that is unavoidable if you're going to choose to be in relationship with the others. It doesn't mean that you have to dwell on that all the time. It doesn't mean it's going to look the same for you as it does for another person. I'm not saying that grieving is some like exalted state that you ought to seek to hang out in, but we also tend culturally to push away grief and sorrow. And so often there's a need to reclaim, to embrace that spectrum of experience so that your heart is unblocked and flowing, and that when grief does arise, you're able to move with that and to allow that to move through you. Because the amount of loss and harm that is being enacted is so tremendous. And you can be really active and passionate and freaked out and motivated to change that, and it's still playing out. And so there's a need to slow down and to feel and to be with the reality of the times we're in, which is there's a lot of sorrow in that. It's not only sorrow, but there's also that. And so I see it as a kind of price of entry if you want to be in relationship with the others, and to find ways to grieve with other living humans also in community is really sanity encouraging and helpful, I've found. There's a ton I could say, but I want to keep it a little bit high level like that by just looking at core values rather than getting into how it would look to ritualize these different things. So I'm going to favor responding to questions. So if people would be willing, if you'd be willing to write in your questions, then we'll let that drive our time. And I'll start to respond to some here, and I'll also glance my inbox to see if anybody sent some questions. Okay, I see one from, yeah, good. One person asked to just repeat the way I was describing animism. It's a bioregional. So basically looking at what's your local bioregion, what's your local watershed or ecological zone, and how to say it. I lived in the California Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area for 11 years up until 4 years ago. And I did hundreds of days of place-oriented outdoor ritual there. It was very informative and nourishing and good for me. And I knew it was going to be intense to move, and I still underestimated how intense it would be, because I have yet to feel rooted in that same way here in North Carolina, although I'm working at it. And it's a source of real sorrow for me. I go back to the Bay Area and I feel that part of me is still there in the land and with the land. And it doesn't make sense really for me to move back there. It's a lot of factors, but it helped me to understand just a fraction of the harm that's done to indigenous place-rooted peoples around the world when less place-rooted people, more typically more colonizing forces, displace or aggressively dislocate people from the places they've come to know. Because the spirits whose bodies are the land and nature there are, that is the society. The society is not limited to just humans. And so to uproot someone from a place and force them to be in another place is to say you cannot practice your traditions. You need to no longer be in relationship with these powers. It's a kind of aggression that colonizer type folks who have not been very place oriented and whose religious views are more abstract, they don't appreciate the full depth of the harm that's happening. And so, so let your animism be bioregional. Let it be place oriented. That's what I'm saying. And that includes facing the history, depending on where you're at, but let's assume that many of you are in the Americas, facing the history of genocide toward Native and African ancestor peoples in the Americas, and which might also include you, or it might include, an element of who you are, because so many people are multiracial. And to face those histories is part of coming into relationship with the land where we're at. And it's a kind of pain and a kind of, do I have permission to be here? Is it okay for me to love the earth here, despite the history of colonizing people? Those are raw and important questions to wrestle with. So, but we call it bioregional animism, to answer your question. Moshe is asking who writes well about what kind of rights the other than human people have. And I would just look up rights of nature as a movement. Of course, indigenous tribal peoples around the world have thousands of diverse, different ways of thinking about the accountability that humans have with the other than humans. And so I'm not steeped in who is taking specific indigenous models and articulating them in a more Western legal language. But if you look at the way that, let's say, Quechua-speaking communities in Bolivia or Maori-speaking people in New Zealand are adapting the rights of nature ethic into the legal systems in those countries, that would be a starting point for how to see those articulations. Yeah. From thanks for the questions coming in. From Arturo, can the other than humans of one place have a connection to another place? Like, would the water spirits in BC have a connection with the water spirits in Hawaii? Oh, it's a great question. So I'm an initiate, for example, of Oshun, who is a goddess of an orisha of the fresh water and rivers in Yoruba culture. And so more specifically, she's the deity of the Oshun River, the Odo Oshun. And yet, when my Yoruba elders were here in Asheville in September, we did a ritual at the river to honor Oshun. Now, we could have also done a ritual at the river to honor Yemoja or Oya, who are also goddesses of specific rivers, but river goddesses more generally, both. I don't know the traditions that are used to honor the French Broad River. There are, this is Tsilagi or Eastern Band Cherokee traditional territory, but to the degree that there are specific rituals to honor that specific river, they're not made publicly, you know, they're not known publicly, and I'm not in a position to presume to do them because I don't know them, and I'm, you know, I'm not presuming to do any of that. And to my knowledge, there's certainly not a different priesthood for the different rivers here in Western North Carolina. So this is I get into it in part two of the animism course, and it's the most like tangled, confused kind of topic in the whole course, which is deities and the relationship of specific gods, archetypes, we call them Irumale in Yoruba culture, deities, with in this topic of animism. Because the deities are, in a sense, universal powers. A Yoruba person or a practitioner of Yoruba, tradition, like myself, Shango is a deity of lightning and other things, but also lightning. And so when there's lightning here, as there was last night, I might be like, oh, Kabiesi, Shango, Kawo, what's up? Good to see your face. And so Shango is not the deity of Yoruba lightning. Is a deity of lightning, period. So Yoruba people here seeing lightning are like, what's up, Shango? So there is a way in which it's universal, and there's a way in which the powers are, they do have their place of rootedness. Now, honoring Oshun at the Oshun River is especially potent. I had the opportunity to support at a Sundance, which is a plain-style ceremony, Wiwongwa Chipi, at least in Lakota language, and that was being done on Bainbridge Island in traditional Suquamish territory in Washington State. It was years ago, but what I was struck by is like, huh, this is like, it's kind of cool and rainy. And in my impression, at least, not presuming to know, it's just my impression, is that the spirits of that place were like, okay, y'all can do a Sundance here, it's fine. I mean, it seemed to ritually be working, but it didn't seem unusually congruous with the energy of that land. And there were Suquamish elders who were guiding the ritual because some Native North American ceremonial ways are shared intertribally. And it's fine. I'm not presuming to judge any of that, but I'm saying that certain systems, spiritual systems, grow out of a kind of ecosystem, and they can feel choppier in other places. Practicing Norse traditions in the desert is a little weird, I think, to the gods. They're like, okay, we can adapt. You know, I studied Islam and lived in North Africa for a bit, studied Arabic, and there are Muslims in, like, Norway. And the prayer schedule is wacky with the day, the times of day, because it's a solar thing. And so the days get really long and strange, and they adapt. And so desert cultures being practiced in Scandinavia feel a little choppy, I think. And so certain spirits do have their place of power, and there are universal things both. And it's a nuanced conversation. It's an insightful question, and it's one you kind of need to wrestle with the spirits themselves and be like, well, how do I understand this? Yeah, so good. I kind of see it like the river goddesses. It's like they're a cohort, or we call them the Egbe in Yoruba tradition. They're a crew, and each one has their prominence. Like if you're in India and you're at the Yamuna River, you're going to talk to the Yamuna, the goddess of that river, and she's going to have more precedence than Oshun. But she's a guest in when you're in Oshogbo and you're at the Oshun River, and so each one has its own like place where they especially shine, something like that. Yeah. Good. So if you just keep the questions coming. Sylvia's asking, can I give an example of how the other humans can act harmfully when related with? Why does it happen? How can you prevent it? Yeah. Well, one example would be a disease spirit. There are very friendly, connective spirits of, let's say smallpox. It's one of the deities in the Yoruba tradition, Omolu or Shampona is a deity of infectious disease generally, but smallpox specifically. And so to get smallpox is a kind of intimacy with that one. You know, the dying isn't how we think of it. It's just it's a change of form, but we like this form. There's a lot we can get done in human form, so I don't really want to die today. For a human to get smallpox and die, it's not from the perspective of the deity who expresses itself through smallpox, that's not necessarily an act of aggression. It's an act of intimacy. It's like just giving you a big hug. It's like when you pluck a flower. For you, it's just an act of affection. What a pretty flower. So some deities pluck a human, and sad for you, you die. But for them, they're just being friendly. And so sometimes it's a mismatch of intensity, and you're just playing with it. Like one of the things that's safer about relating with the ancestors is that because they have human form-ish, you're unlikely to get a radical mismatch of intensity. Unlike if you connect directly with the spirit of lightning, there's nothing about that deity that's human only. It may have human faces, but it can blow the feet off of your legs. And it's just being itself. It's not really trying to hurt you. It's just big and cuddly, and you're fragile. And so if you're a mountain, no problem, but you're a human. So one of the most common ways that the other than humans act harmfully, so to speak, toward us is we step into the pathway of a radical mismatch of energy. And it blows up our nervous system or our body, or something happens. And so poison ivy isn't out to get us when we're covered in a rash. It's just being itself. So it's a little more hazardous to relate with the other than humans. Well, I don't know if that's true. Humans are dangerous too. So they're all kind of dangerous. And can I elaborate on the difference between projection versus feeling harmed? Oh, geez. Well, it's no different than how it is with the other living humans. Basically, take what you know about how dynamics with other living humans can either work or become a disaster, and assume that all those things can also happen with the others. Only more complicated, because they have so many different personalities. And so there are some beings that tend to have a generous and receptive temperament, like the spirits of animals and plants often, but not always, tend to have a friendly vibe toward humans. Not always. I assume people can hear my wife and baby upstairs. It's good. Just trying to focus. But some of the other than humans have very big presences, and there may be a history of harm that's been played out toward them from humans. And so we end up, a way that other than humans project onto us is probably the most common form of projection, which is globalizing, of saying, you know, if 10 humans in a row come to a place and relate poorly with the land there, and you're human number 11 who's like the friendly, open-hearted, I'm going to make an offering, and I love you, I love the earth, and the land has been related with so badly, it's really understandable to be like, humans equal bad news, doom, make rocks fall on their head, you know, protect the area. And so you can whine about that, but it's really just recognizing that you, like it or not, represent this form. If you've been stung by 10 yellow jackets in a row, and an 11th one lands on your arm, you're not going to be like, oh, this is like the first time we've ever seen each other. It's so good. You're going to be edgy because you've just been stung 10 times in a row, right? And so the other than humans sometimes have that get the fuck away vibe toward us. And that's really understandable because in many parts of the world, including the Americas, many people, especially non-locals in the last however many centuries, five centuries, give or take, have related really harmfully with the others. So there's a field of energy that's like mistrust that you walk into when you seek to just connect with the land. If you find that you're bumping into that, that's a good sign. It means you're actually connecting and you're actually perceiving what's going on. And so the invitation is to be patient and open and receptive and generous and not take it too personally. So, yeah, let me say just that. But in general, Sylvia, to your question is, whatever we know about human-to-human relationships, apply all that same complexity to the others and anticipate we're going to recreate our bad childhood dynamics and how we relate with the earth and the trees and, you know, the hummingbirds. That's good news because it means we see them as actual people if we start doing that. Yeah. Good. keep the questions coming. Oh, thoughts about having an animist worldview in an academic setting. Any thoughts you might have about that? Yeah, you should do it. no, beyond that, it depends what kind of academic setting. You know, what happens is it's a start, but sometimes in academic settings, certainly not always, but it's better than it was a minute ago. Academic environments, because they're, assuming they're not led by Indigenous folks, those in charge might be afraid to be shamed for being racist, which is a good thing to be afraid of. And so there, if someone who's like clearly Indigenous is like, I'm going to post up and be relational about it because this is how our people see it, and you really want to fight me publicly on record about this, you'd be like, oh, no, that's okay. It's cool. Like, so they'll tend to be at least a willingness to tolerate other than Western views if the person's body doesn't look white. And so for someone who, I'm generalizing here, cut me some slack. So I'm saying if your ancestry suggests that you should think in a colonialist privileged way, then you might actually, in one sense, it might be harder to bring this alternative view into the academy. You know, on the other hand, people might take you more seriously because you're a white person, which is annoying, but you can leverage it, I suppose. So there are people like Graham Harvey's work is someone I find a lot of inspiration from, his book Animism, Respecting the Living World. There are people within science communities as well who are articulating a more relational ethic. Like if you're doing research with the small organisms or with the animals or plants, to actually speak with them, listen to them. But that gets into what is admissible evidence and what kind of, you know, are you really going to have Indigenous epistemologies or ways of knowing permitted? Like for botany, for example, if people haven't seen her work, Robin Wall Kimmerer is a really inspiring, she's Potawatomi or I'm not sure all the Indigenous nations, but she weaves like botany, Western science with Indigenous wisdom in really beautiful ways. And so people like that are blazing some trails. But yeah, there are so many different settings that require a shakeup around this. And so, yeah, lean in and see if there are other people kind of grouped together. If you group together, there's a touch more safety to it. Good. Question from Gina. This might be too in-depth of a topic. Can I speak more on the grief that comes with relating and witnessing the suffering in the world? Oh, geez. I can try to a little bit. it's two out of the 14 lessons in the Animism course are all about ritually how to work with this. And there's a talk in the archive of talks all on grief. But a few key things are that if possible, you want to have your grieving be within a range of tolerance that your nervous system can handle. Like if you're not crying, you're not grieving, you're not accessing the grief, dig a little deeper. Like find support for it. Find out what helps you to get there. You might have a hard time getting there alone. You might need to talk in order to get there. You might need to be alone. You might need to have a glass of wine. You might, whatever it is, you might need to do a lot of things, but find ways to access, to actually dig deep enough to get the water. And if your problem is more like, oh my God, as soon as I go there, I'm flooded and blown out and overwhelmed and underwater, which is what tends to be the case for people that ask questions like the one you just asked, Gina, then the challenge is more, excuse me, about understanding that you have a certain range of intensity that your nervous system can handle. And it's good to hang out there. If you go past that range of intensity, you know, it just is. But it's not necessarily helpful grieving at that point. And we don't always have an option. Sometimes you're just laid out because something big happens and you're just going to grieve as long, you know, until you're not. But being in the range of intensity is where you want to hang out, if possible. The range that your nervous system can handle, rather. Things that can extend that range are being in community. The community functions like a booster for the nervous system. Like when you're grieving and someone's holding you, and it's like, we got you, honey, we got you. We are here with you. We totally have your back. Suddenly you have like 20% more range of intensity that you can hang with. And if you feel deeply connected and not alone when you're grieving, then you, all the more range you have. And so through practice, you can become able to move even stronger grief through your system and not be rocked by it. I'm skeptical of all that media hype in general, but, and I forget her name. I think it's Emma something. One of the young women in the Parkland shooting was just speaking, and I was listening to it, and it was, I think, in DC yesterday or the day before, and you know, just kind of tuning out, and then she stopped talking and was just holding space and weeping, but not caving in, really holding like upright, like this is the face of grief without speaking. So lovely, like so potent. And so to me, what was moving about that is she's modeling, like basically channeling a collective grief, because you can't help but channel if you're open and you're in that position on stage holding all this energy. She was doing that. And also, I would suggest drawing on the extended nervous system of all the support in order to be able to hold it, to channel it, and to not cave in, to not waver, but to just hold presence. And so grieving with connection is the challenge. And the others that hold you, they don't have to be human. They can be other than human, the earth and the spirits and all of it. So, yeah, powerful. If you haven't seen it, give it a glance. I'm going to go to folks who haven't chimed in yet first. I see some other questions. Why do I call these others other than humans versus other beings, since other than humans still centers humans and can sound like it otherizes these other beings? Oh, good. Yeah, no, let's talk about that. So partly I'm drawing on the other beings. I don't think, how to say, it's, to me, like for whales, we're other than whales. For, you know, cedar trees, we're other than cedar trees. And so partly it's just because my audience right now is humans. And so I'm speaking about them as other than human because it's the most neutral way I know to speak about it. I don't like the word beings because it we don't talk about other people like that. Be like, yeah, you know, I had these three beings over. We were having some beers. People are like, were they humans? What was going on? And so I want to use the word, in English, I think the word to go to is people. There are other kinds of people. And now they might not be human people. They're other kind, you know, they're tree people or, you know, badger people. And so I think that's the most psychologically intimate language to use and accurate. And it's also legally, it legally works because we're talking about personhood legally. And so that's the language to move forward with, I think. And I just, when I say other than human, all I mean is their form is different than ours. It's the most neutral way I know to talk about it. And it's when I teach about ancestors, that's a kind of discrete community. That's all the humans that are not incarnate right now. Like, I know how to start to talk about that. When I talk about other than humans, that's talking about everything else in the whole vast universe. And so it reveals our cultural awkwardness to even make that a topic, because it's such a vast topic. But where I'm really coming from in the teaching is helping people to really grasp and know how to internalize and socially defend and enact in their own life the core values that we're talking about. So it's not this esoteric, abstract, spiritual thing, but it's something you could talk about with your family at the holidays, or you could talk about it with your colleagues at work. Be like, oh yeah, it's actually a really normal thing. It's very sad and unusual that some modern Western people have come to have a habit of acting so unethically as to make invisible these other people, just because these other people aren't human people. And to have that be a really normal language. And so, yeah, I don't, I could see how in a way it, you could say it centers humans, but it's only like that until you specify who you're talking about. Okay, now we're having a conversation about the tree people. Which ones? We're talking about the tulip poplars here. Okay, so let's just talk about tulip poplar then. And then we drop this language of other than humans. It's only present at this real, like, abstract high level that we're talking about. Yeah, and because there's precedent for it. And there's few enough people focusing on this that I don't want to reinvent the wheel with it. Yeah, so, but how we talk about it is kind of a mess. It's true. Just sometimes I just say the others. Yeah, good. There's a question from Rana. Do I feel that fields that receive a high quantity of human love have a consciousness that wants to reciprocate? Meaning, I think what you're asking is, do other kinds of people that we give a lot of attention to and we have a lot of good attitude toward, do they tend to have a good feeling toward us in response? Like, do panda bears have more warm feeling than us toward fleas, than fleas, let's say, because we tend to have a bad attitude toward fleas? Something like that. Like, is there a sense of culturally that the other, that the people we favor culturally tend to favor us back? Is that what you're asking? Mm-hmm. Kind of, yeah. I think so. And then you're asking about Lyme. Suggestions for creating ritual on harmful parasitic infections to release their hold. It's not a ritual specialization of mine. I would know how to go about asking the right questions, but I haven't sought to do it. And so there are some lizards, for example, that carry a quality in their blood that neutralizes Lyme when ticks that are infected with Lyme bite them. So it actually causes the tick to no longer be carrying the Lyme disease. And I think it's Eastern Fence Lizard. I'm not sure which it is. But if I imagine opening a conversation with the spirochete that is Lyme and with the deer tick, and with my ancestors to, like, make sure it didn't get too crazy as a conversation because I'm talking to these strange beings that I don't usually interact with, and disease spirits, I would also want to include voices like the Eastern Fence Lizard. And and to understand who are, like, basically, if you're going to try to negotiate a healing outcome, it's my bias that you want to really listen carefully first and understand who you're talking to. And so the more, we had a ritual we did in Mount Diablo in the Bay Area once, maybe 8 years ago, the Phytophthora remora, the sudden oak death, has a strong impact on the oak trees around the Bay Area. And so we had different people tuning into the oaks on different mountains and some of the oaks on the land where we're at. We're in ritual on Mount Diablo. So there are blue oaks and coast live oaks, black oaks, you know, different kinds of interior live oak, etc. But one of the people in the group, the one who had actually the most judgment about the, I think it's an oomycete, it's a kind of protist, that's the infectious agent that is sudden oak death. It's this black kind of schmutz that harms the oak trees in a really sad way. So it was her job to tune into that one. And it was really touching because she came to have a very shifted view of it. The judgment softened and melted away. And she was seeing just the ecological role of that organism and its intelligence and its own like sentience and personality, basically, as a, you know, sudden oak death person, you know, whatever. We have Latin names for them, but we don't have good common names. And what I'm suggesting is that if you're going to negotiate with the beings whose bodies cause Lyme illness in humans, then you would want to start from that level of connectivity in order to just be able to have the conversation. Because you're doing basically like family therapy, but some of the family members are ticks and viruses and, you know, strange other prions and, you know, beings that, you know, are unusual compared to human form. So if we come from that radical, like, inclusivity, relational, non-judgmental stance, there's a possibility that we could have a conversation that opens up that's surprising and interesting. That's how a lot of traditional healing generally happens, is around infectious diseases. The specialists who have the capacity to do it will negotiate with them. But to do that, you have to approach carefully and not be provocative. You can't bust in and be like, stop doing this. And they'll be like, oh, and you're next. So, yeah. Good. Thanks, Rhonda. But I haven't done it, so I don't know. I'm sure some people have, but I just haven't sought to. Yeah. What if, oh good, there's some questions. So what if somebody intuits that a human loved one is having difficulty because their profession is harming the land? Is there a way to ask those other than human people who are being harmed to not harm one's loved one? Or would it be too dangerous to try to draw their attention to oneself? Well, yeah. Capitalism sucks. That's my first thought on that, is our exploitative, liberal, whatever the fuck to call it, version of capitalism sucks, if I want to be more nuanced about it. Meaning that it doesn't feel fair to me to say people who work in extractive industries are just big dumb losers who should do something else. Because it comes from a stance of real privilege to be that simplistic about it. I also think it's problematic to just defend everyone working in extractive, directly ecologically harmful industries, because people also have agency, and on some level we should know better. So that's also a little bit true. And blaming working class people for corporate greed is also problematic. So, you know, people in banking and stocks and, you know, more abstracted but ultimately more implicated roles, those folks might, yeah, you know, they might not have blood directly on their hands, but they do in some ways have the most blood on their hands. And so is it possible that somebody's incurring consequence for their soul, their body, all the above, because they work in a field that is harmful to the earth? Yeah, absolutely. in some ways for you to appeal for them to not be harmed is doing them a disservice, because it is presuming to shield them from the consequences of their actions, which prevents them from fully maturing as a soul, because they don't, we don't want to be protected from the consequences of our actions, because it slows accountability and maturation. Now, I'm not saying that you should pray for them to be harmed either. And in a practical sense, if they were a witchy person, or if you love them and you're a witchy person and you care for them, you could appeal to the spirits of the land and make offerings, depending on who's being harmed, and to just explain the situation and be like, look, I'm not presuming to know what needs to happen, but I know I love this person. And so if there's something I can do to temper the wrath that you feel toward them, I'm open to understanding what that might be. So you can ask. It's okay to ask. I would ask your own ancestors or powers that you know and trust, rather than the ones being harmed directly. Like, you want some kind of tempering or intermediate force in there, so you just don't get dragon fire on your face when you ask. So ask through a mediator. So it's not inherently too dangerous. Most things aren't too dangerous to try. You just need the layers of protection and mediation between you and that thing, and the ability to back up if it gets actually dangerous and run away and hide and wait for it to get less dangerous. So you can try. I don't mean to make light of the question. It is really harmful to the soul to have to work in vocations that harm the earth, and it's painful, and it's super real. So respect for what you're asking there. Yeah, it's good. How to incorporate animism in daily life, especially with children? Yes, just talk out loud to the other than humans as if they're people. That's the main, most important practice that I recommend to people, is break the unconscious agreement that comes through colonialist thinking, reductionistic thinking. Break that agreement that says only living humans are real, and especially white people, and especially men, or, you know, whatever, just all the dumb ways that we objectify other humans sometimes. So break the agreement that legitimizes only humans by talking to the other than humans as family members, as kin. Not just the cat, but also the cat, if you have a cat, and the houseplants. Talk to them as friends and teach the children etiquette about how to interact with wild plants and how to ask permission and when to pick up a thing when they're out in nature and when to leave it. And, I mean, you kind of have to know those things yourself or wrestle with them, or you won't know how to teach a person. But talk out loud to the others. Normalize it. That's the main thing. And if you do that, and the younger people see you doing that, they're going to pick it up and see that it's normal, and that it doesn't have to be a thing. Yeah, it's normal. So do it like that. The children's books are great for that. We've been reading our daughter Goodnight, Goodnight Construction Site, and it's my favorites already. I'm like, oh, this is great. The bulldozer and it's not just like, oh, the animals are people. It's like, oh, the bulldozer person is going to sleep and everything. So I'm like, why do we stop doing that? It's totally like that. People just talk to their bulldozers. So good. Another question here. And we'll take just another 10 minutes. Of course, if people need to peel off, it's fine, but just responding to questions. I'm looking at Aaron's question, it's a little long, so give me a sec to metabolize it. Yeah. I think, Aaron, you're basically saying the way that I'm talking about consent violations and having negative experiences that affect our way of connecting with others sounds like PTSD. It can include post-traumatic stress disorder, but remember, I'm a clinician, so I tend to use the language of PTSD or trauma a little more narrowly. In popular language, trauma gets used to refer to, sometimes used to refer to like a Facebook post you didn't like that you were traumatized by. And I'm like, respectfully, you had a strong feeling, but that's different than trauma. Now, so when I say that living humans can bring their PTSD, their insecure attachment or psychological wounding and weird filters that typically come from bad experiences into their relationships with other than humans, for sure, that includes but isn't limited to trauma. Am I suggesting that the other than humans can also have what we might conceptualize of as trauma and even like personality disorders or ways that their consciousness has been shaped because of relating with us? I am suggesting that. I think it's a little, you get into thin ice if you start giving a psychological diagnosis to the other than humans. But if we're going to really see them as complex people, then we need to allow for a whole range of complex reactions to us. If you want to know if it's possible to shape the psyche or the soul or the personality of a whole other species, consider beings like coffee, chicken, corn, rice, and beings who we have profoundly altered through seeing them through the filter of our need and hunger. Cotton. You could ask the spirit of cotton how cotton feels about the history of human slavery in the Americas and being brought into that story. Or the way that European slavery, enslavement of Africans, is driven in part by white people's enjoyment of sugar and the strong demand for the exporting of sugar from the Americas and cotton. And so how do those other than human people feel about being brought into that horrific history? Well, I don't want to speak for them, but you could ask them. It's a good question. It's an insightful question. If you actually want to be in relationship to sugar cane, and because its story is bound up in the human story and its body has been altered, we can ask these other beings, how do you feel about us combining your genome with beings that aren't even plants, and to bring bioluminescent fungus into the body of a goat? Is that consensual? Probably not. So maybe we shouldn't fucking do it. Just saying. I don't personally object to genetically modified organisms because of human health consequences, although that's a fine reason to have caution about them. I object to that technology because it's not consent-based, and it creates ill will with the others, and it harms us on a soul level to act in non-consensual ways. But people aren't going to talk about it that way, because then we're talking about it in this superstitious animist way that colonialist thinking tends to shame people for. So when you get shamed for taking something about what we're talking about here into your work environment, into the family gathering, notice that that tendency of people to shame you and the part of you that might actually contract a little, that's like colonialism in miniature. Like you're playing out these big archetypal patterns. And for you to hold your space and actually know that your relational stance is just as intelligent and legitimate and defensible as a more reductionist stance, that's the confidence we're looking for here. So just a few more questions and we'll finish up. There's a question from K Kim, can I talk more about non-equality among other than humans? There's a real quest for equality among many humans, and it seems necessary with all the historic troubles, yet there's not equality among the spirits. So translating that to non-humans as an expectation seems problematic. I think I follow, but the, equality is, there's a great passage. I haven't even read the book. I just know of the passage from the Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver. Of they're trying to indoctrinate, I think it's indigenous community in the Congo, maybe in democracy and also Christianity. And so the local community at a certain point votes out Jesus. And the Christians are like, well, you can't do that. Wait a minute. They're like, what do you mean? I thought we were doing democracy. What happened? So they get all into it, right? But the thing that the traditional community, at least in the story, and I agree with this, is objecting to about democracy is that the people who are foolish and wise get an equal say. And it's the same reason I struggle a bit with the attempts at representative democracy in the United States, and because we don't have an educated populace entirely, and so we get problematic outcomes. But so equality, the shadow side of equality, if we don't really bring a nuance to it, is that it doesn't respect difference. And it's a kind of aggression to make everyone out to be the same. And not because not everyone has the same capacities. If I go upstairs with our 4-month-old and be like, we're equal in this house. You need to do the dishes and I'll do them the next day and then Sarah's going to do them the next day. It's not going to work out. And so it's an easy example to use like parents and children with that. But everyone's got their own particular kind of shine and position and capacity. And so what is... for me, it's more about respecting the sovereignty of other beings and knowing what is accountability look like in this specific relationship. What's our specific dance together? And to not generalize too much. I'm probably missing, Kim, the heart of your question, but that's what comes to mind when I read it, at least. Good. So we'll finish in just a sec here. I hope it's been interesting to try to talk about this a bit. It's a fruitful challenge for me to say, how can we speak from this relational stance about all different kinds of aspects of life, not just ritual, spirituality, and to speak about the different aspects of life from the stance so that it's normal, so that it's how we approach policy, relationships, social justice work, cultural healing work, our everyday life and vocation, our food, our art, whatever it is. If sinking into this further is something you're drawn to, for the first time, I've developed a full-length online course that starts in mid-April on the 15th, and it's 14 lessons, about once a week with breaks, but you pace it on your own rhythm, and so it'll go into the summer. And we have about 60, 70 people, and it'll be open to the end of April. The exchange on it is flexible if the cost is a barrier. And there's a bit of a ritual element to it, but really it's more of a psychological dive into reclaiming our relationships with the bodies who are in nature, spirits of place, close to where you live, because that's where the action's at. It's the ones who's bodies you're already eating, the ones who already know you because you walk by them in the morning, because they feel you dreaming when you sleep at night. And so those ones, if we can actually turn and greet them, it can make our life really more magical and relational without a lot of extra stuff. We're working with what's already happening in a more conscious way, so we don't need to add other things into the mix. So if that's of interest to you, then just reach out. And I will just include here, it's at the top of the chat as well, but that's my email. And so it's ancestralmedicine.org. And this talk will be up on the site under ancestralmedicine.org/talks. by sometime tomorrow. And I send out a monthly newsletter if you want to be in the loop about stuff. But this is what I am doing with my life, and it's good. And there's job security because we're culturally really in the deep end and in a lot of crisis right now. So thank you for your time and engagement, everybody. And that's what I got. Thanks. Ashe.
Thank you, Daniel.